World War One Air War, miscellaneous. I have taught whole classes on World War One, and I find it a really fascinating war, particularly since they have so many secrecy documents, 75 to 100 years, as I talked about before in the Avenger podcast. But the air war is the funny part. It's the fun part, the romantic part of World War One. You know, we get in these planes and we're flying along, you know, and the man, the early ones are doing 55, 60 miles an hour. I think they got up, you know, probably in the 90s, toward the end of the war. And these things are crates. I mean, they're canvas, they're wire, they're balsa. If you see documentaries on World War One planes, you'll see these guys carrying broken wings into the hangar and fitting a rear panel wing by banging it with their hand and sliding it into place. You know, these are planes that are so difficult to fly that if you turn too fast, the wings fall off. If you try to accelerate and gain altitude too fast, your engine stalls and then you crash. And if you dive too fast, your wings fall off. I mean, it's like a flying death trap. And I just wanted to give you some just general miscellaneous stuff to kind of pique your interest in the, just some of the odd things that you can find on the war. And then I'll go through some of the people, some of the big combat people later on, Billy Bishop, Rick Toffin, you know, some of those characters. You know, there are, you know, planes are, you know, we've got the Wright brothers, you know, and they're just, you know, have just come into use. There wasn't any discussion about the use of air power. I mean, it's what do we do with it? I mean, the early uses of the planes is they would fly over aerial reconnaissance just to look with their eyes. Okay, later on they'll put cameras on the planes. They weren't armed initially, so you would fly over and you'd wave at the German guy, and you know, well, you know how it is. Then eventually somebody waves at the German guy, pulls a pistol out, plugs at him, throw grenades at each other, take rifles up. Pretty soon now we've got a back seat with a machine gun. Because you can't shoot the machine gun through the front of your plane for the very simple reason that it's not timed. So you just shoot your propeller off. Now, Heron Guerot, one of the great aviating experimenters, one of the great pilots pre-war, is flying for France. And this guy, and he's not the only one to do it, he put metal deflectors on his propeller, rigged up that machine gun. And I think the early planes carried 300 rounds of ammunition. There's not a lot of room for those things. And he would fire through the front of his plane for a while, you know, and the Germans were just really puzzled. Well, eventually he gets shot down, he crash lands, they capture him, and they realize he has these metal deflectors. Well, it appears that on the average of every 100 bullets that he fired, 6 of them would hit that propeller and ricochet back. And one article I read claimed that anywhere from 4 to 6 French pilots had been killed by their own ricochet. And the next step is the Germans hired this Dutch inventor, Antoni Fokker, yeah, F-O-K-K-E-R, to come up with a less suicidal device. And then he comes up with the putting a thing on it so that it hesitates the moment the blade passes in front of the machine gun. And so the Germans, for at least 3 weeks, have front-mounted machine guns that aren't being ricocheted, and they're just blasting the British to pieces. Now, there's an unofficial story. I've got in a couple of books of slang, they have this. In a couple of books, they claim it really wasn't true. So I'm just putting it in here just for the heck of it. But there was supposed to be a joke that, you know, if you got shot down, you got focked. In other words, that you got shot down by the Fokker plane. And they called it the Fokker Scourge there for a while. So you know, the guys in trenches will do all sorts of odd things. But let's put you in the plane and look at this. Okay, it's got an altimeter. It has a speed thing. There's no radar. That's another war away. The early planes, some of them didn't have windshields. You imagine flying along there, you know, wham, take a bird in the face, bugs. There's no heat, so you got to wear these suits. Some of them wore football helmets. Some of them wore these big fancy cold weather outfits. Then they'll put windscreens on them. So when you fly up into a cloud, I mean, head-on collisions, you know, all sorts of stuff. They had a lot of problems taking off because frequently, if you watch documentaries, you'll see a whole group of them take off side by side at the same time instead of one going out the next one. You know, if somebody gets the wrong direction and makes the wrong turn, you can take out a bunch of the planes. Taking off was extremely hazardous. Now, you're flying the plane. Where's the gas can at? The gas can is under the front of the where the engine is. You're sitting in the plane. You've got your legs out. You've got the stick between your legs. And there's your little control panel. And right there above your legs is the gasoline can. So if you get shot through the front and it pops a hole in that gasoline container, that gasoline will drip on your legs, which is why so many of these pilots burned up. There was a documentary done probably 7 or 8 years ago. A place in New Jersey has vintage planes that they fly at certain times. You can go and visit them. And they were doing a documentary, and so they were flying some of these vintage planes. And they're flying along, and the pilot says, "Uh-oh." And the guy with the camera says, "What do you mean, uh-oh?" And he said, "Well, you know, we got to land. We got a leak in the gas can there. I'm covered in gasoline." And then come on down. They had a little trouble at the beginning of the war with what kind of oil to use in the engine. And they decided to use castor oil. And they found that, of course, castor oil uses a laxative in liquid form. They found that the burning smell of the castor oil would make the pilots sick as well. In Britain, the average, well, let's see, they usually gave you about 3 weeks training. And when you think about training to be a pilot, to fly in World War I, remember that training means they're teaching you how to fly and then what to do once you get up into the air, which is why there are so many wrecks and casualties. The mechanics are gods here. You know, every pilot had his favorite mechanic. And if you were a good mechanic, you would move from unit to unit with that pilot. That's what the Germans did. And after the war, when a lot of guys went around barnstorming, they took with them their favorite mechanic and what have you. Give you an idea just how, a lot of times people say, well, how many planes did they use? There is a website. It's called Aerodrome. And aerodrome.com. And I think it's the best one. I've used it a lot in my classes because it lists all the aces from every country. It lists all the, there are pictures of planes, there are drawings of planes, there are schematics, there's all sorts of things associated with the air war. They don't have a lot of the little side stuff. You have to get that from reading other books and accounts of various people. But it's really good. As a matter of fact, I'll show you how good it is. I had a student about 6 years ago. He came to class one day and had a suitcase and a trunk. And we're on World War II. And I always tell the kids, you know, if you have something that's not a weapon and your family would like to bring it in to show us, we'll look at it. So the boy brought it in World War II, and his dad said, well, it's been up in the attic. It was great-grandpa's. He thought it was World War II. I opened the thing up. Oh, it's all World War I. You know, it's a Steinheim helmet. It's got a spiked helmet. It's got a bunch of stuff. But he collected pieces of things. And in that was this black piece of canvas. And I saw it black side up, and I'm thinking, holy cow, this guy's got a piece of a plane. But there's no way I'm ever going to know that's what it is. Well, no, yeah, there was, because when I flipped it over, pinned to it was a piece of paper. And on the note, it said, piece of an albatross shot down by Eddie Rickenbacker, such and such a date. And I guess it had gone down and where he was in the trenches, and then went out and got some souvenirs. So I went to the aerodrome, looked up Eddie Rickenbacker. By golly, it listed the date. Actually shot two planes down, but one of them was not an albatross. So we could get the name of the pilot that was shot down, the location it was. I was able to print up a picture of both the guy he shot down and Rickenbacker. and then we made a little display for the family. That's the kind of stuff that you can get there. But this is what I found fascinating. It has a list of all the planes that everybody built. So, for example, the French built 67,987 planes during World War One, and they lost 52,640 of them. That is astounding. Probably most of them are by accidents. And a lot of guys crashed multiple times. I mean, Richthofen crashed several times before he got the hang of flying. It just depended on how you went down. Now, Britain did a little better. Britain produced 58,144 planes and only lost 35,973. And then our German friends, they built 48,537 and only lost 27,637. So they lost a little more than half of what they built. But the French lost almost 90%. The British lost 60-65%. Their figures for the Americans are a little misleading, because we actually go into the war when it was declared without any planes, because we lost them all chasing Pancho Villa in northern Mexico. Most of them, they were called flying coffins, affectionately. They crashed or broke down. I think one was supposedly shot down by pistol fire, but I'm going to do a little thing on the AEF running around in northern Mexico a little bit later on. A lot of the books on World War One air wars are unit-specific. There's one entitled Germany's First Air Force, 1914-1918, by Kilduff, K-I-L-D-U-F-F. Then there's another one, French Air Service Chronology, by Bailey. And the Lafayette Escadrille, by Mason. Now, the Lafayette Escadrille is the Americans that fought before we declared war. And they are a really wild bunch of guys. Pet lions and whiskey and running around with all the ladies. Some really good stories there. We'll deal with those a little bit later on. So a lot of stuff with World War One. But look at some of those documentaries. There's a series. I've got this 26-part series, about 30 minutes each, on World War One. It's all documentary footage. And they do one specifically on the air war, and it's really funny. We had a teacher in our district who built a 90% full size replica of the British Newport. I'm sorry, the French Newport, and he would go to air shows, and his wife would get there before he did because she could drive faster than he could fly. So it's really strange, because remember, when you're watching those documentaries, that film speed is faster. I don't know how he kept from killing any of them, because you could easily track them with a rifle. So, hope you enjoyed this little teaser here on the World War One Air Force, and thanks for listening, and don't forget to come by sumahistorica.com.